From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we go to Moscow to speak with analyst Mark Sloboda. We're looking at the situation shaping up around Ukraine. It looks like it's getting a little tepid there. Mark, maybe you could clue us in what's going on.
Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you on CPR.
It's our pleasure to have you.
Yeah. Okay. So, unless you, are complete Luddite and have excluded yourself from the news media, whether in the U.S. or largely in much of the rest of the world because of the power of Western media, you probably would have seen some headlines about, "Oh my God, Russia is about to invade Ukraine again." If you'll remember, right. We heard. This same back in March or April of this year, oh my God, Russia is about to invade Ukraine again. And if you will look back through the media, you will find that regularly about every 5 or 6 months for the last 6 years,
yeah.
Since 2015.
2014,
right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. So what makes this time different? Why should you believe that Russia is about to invade Ukraine now? Mm. Well, first of all, let's set the terms. When the U.S. sends its military to other countries, it is an intervention, right?
Yes.
that's the terminology that they use. But of course, if Russia sends its troops to one of its neighbors to stop a government that overthrew a democratically elected government with open foreign backing and is shelling and killing its own people. Right. Well, that would be an invasion.
Right.
However,
that's right. That's right.
Particularly when that regime in question has geopolitically realigned the country to be with the United States. That's the story. And you will hear lots of U.S. screaming because the big beef that Russia is raising and has been raising that forms the whole backdrop of this long, long saga is the relentless expansion of NATO over the entirety of Europe, right up to Russia's borders and including, every country that they can of the former Soviet Union,
right.
Except for Russia itself. And if you will remember back, way back in ancient history to the time of Boris Yeltsin, right. And for the first few years of the Putin administration in the early 2000s, Russia itself asked to join NATO. They were like,
correct.
Yeah, we're all for that common security architecture. We should all be, together. And they were just completely rebuffed, mocked, laughed at derisively in the halls of NATO in Brussels, and certainly in Washington, D.C. and London.
It was a cute trick, too, because when they asked to join and they were told no, and everyone around them was being allowed to or asked to join or coups being arranged for them to join. And they said, geez, NATO being pointed at us. And they were like, nah, you're being paranoid. And then another country on Russia's border would be hosting NATO troops, and it's encircled completely again.
Now, if you'll remember the raison d'etre of Russia, of NATO from the beginning, it was to keep the U.S. in Europe, to keep the Soviets out of Europe, and to keep Germany down. I mean, that's the way it was summarized at the time of its creation.
And the official line here, by the way, was to contain the Soviet Union. They've contained it right up to the pit in the middle now, okay? And they're still moving forward.
And yes, the Soviet Union, dissolved itself, collapsed. They lost the Cold War, if you believe the Western narrative of the events, back in the early 1990s.
Right.
So that has left NATO expanding ever faster towards Russia's borders and staking out claims in nearby countries like Ukraine and Georgia, where the West has been, I think it's pretty safe to say, at a minimum, meddling in their domestic political affairs, if you want to say staging color revolutions in order to bring anti-Russian, pro-Western governments into power that will bring their governments into NATO. Right. You know, no matter the public content about the matter. And NATO has... at least some members of NATO have set their sights on Ukraine. And since 2008, Ukraine and Georgia, there was a NATO memorandum from the annual heads of state NATO meeting where it was declared that Ukraine and Georgia would one day join NATO. It was going to happen someday. Yep. That has not changed. It has not been revoked. It has not been fulfilled either. Neither Ukraine nor Georgia have been granted a membership action plan because Russia has made it clear that bringing either one of those countries, on its, shall we say, southern and southwestern, soft underbelly, geopolitically speaking, would be a national security red line. And it would prefer to have some neutral countries on its borders that form a buffer between what is undoubtedly a hostile, aggressive military organization. And let's be clear, NATO has never, ever been used for its supposed purpose of self-defense against another state.
Right.
Never. Right. It has, however, been involved in a whole host of military operations around the world, usually trailing or close in footsteps or providing political support for U.S. military aggression around the world, whether right. we're talking Afghanistan, Iraq, where it followed close behind, Libya, where it was used pretty from the beginning, and then you have this opt-in out opt-out thing where some NATO member states participate and the other NATO member states that don't want to go say actively into Syria just stay quiet. There's no condemnation, no criticism, that sort of operation. NATO has become a tool for two things. Obviously, the Soviet Union is no longer a threat to Europe. No matter all the hyperbole and hysteria, Russia lacks the economic strength, it lacks the military forces, and it lacks the political will to invade Europe. It has no desire to do so.
Right.
In fact, Russia has been quite definitively on the defensive for the last three decades, and NATO has pushed ever further to Russia's borders. The two purposes of NATO have become not defense against Russia, because that's ridiculous. It has become geopolitical consolidation, okay, of the entirety of Europe up to Russia's borders. And the whole logic of that is, if we don't take – it's like playing Risk. This is the way geopoliticians think.
That's right.
Right, neocons. If we don't take this space on the map, then someone else will and will use that space against us.
Yep.
And with NATO clearly operating under that logic, because countries like Montenegro and North Macedonia, they don't add anything to NATO's defensive value. They create new security commitments that it is not clear that the other, particularly European countries, are inclined to meet. To suggest that they actually meet NATO standards, which have been set the bar really high, is rather ridiculous. Georgia and Ukraine, of course, take the matter even first, and membership has been promised to them at some time in the future. They have ongoing civil conflicts in territory they both claim. Right. Georgia with South Ossetia and Abkhazia that broke away from Georgia as the Soviet Union was splitting apart because of a resurgence of Georgian ethnic nationalism, i.e. Georgia for Georgians, which was the slogan at that time period, and led to a rather nasty little war that most of the rest of the world knew or cared nothing about. Ukraine more recently has had much the same, where the country is split on national identity and geopolitical lines between Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine. It was forced to a crux in 2014 when the Yanukovych administration had flirted with an EU association agreement to bring his country closer economically to the EU, while he already had an existing free trade agreement with Russia via the Commonwealth of Independent States. At the final end, he took a look at the neoliberal shock therapy dictate that was being handed to him, and he said, "Well, Jesus, I can't enact that. That would economically destroy my country. It would privatize all of our state companies and resources. It would unemploy tens of millions of people. It would wreck our economy, and I would never be elected again, and neither would anyone, you know, in my party, the Party of Regions." Right. And he said, "Yeah, I was expecting like $15 billion of funds to help with this, and you gave me zero. Right. Yeah, I can't sign this. No, not now, not under these terms. Right. Hey, Russia, but Russia's offering me a loan without such, political strengths to help, keep my floundering country's economy afloat." Right. And as soon as he said that, his government was targeted for regime change by the U.S. and the EU, and they were quite open and active about this, with EU and U.S. officials and politicians flying into the Maidan, Independence Square in Maidan, doing photo ops with Ukrainian politicians that they had previously condemned as ultra-nationalists, racists, and xenophobes, like Oleg Tyanybok and Andrei Proubi, who would later become the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, right. People who are undoubted neo-Nazis, right? Of course, that they didn't become the front man of the new regime that would be put in place. That was left to the oligarch, the candy oligarch Poroshenko, who had been a part of the Yanukovych administration and two other administrations prior to this, a real insider creature.
Right, exactly.
But
it was a palace coup, with the U.S. backing it.
Yeah, it didn't stop in order to create an anti-Russian Ukraine, right? It is an act of nation creation, right? Because that obviously didn't exist. Now, in order to do that, you need some type of historical and cultural background to form a nation, a national identity. And the only thing in Ukrainian history that was rabidly anti-Russian was the World War II era Nazi collaborators, right, that many in West Ukraine and the Ukrainian diasporas in the U.S. and Canada, where you can still find monuments to Nazi collaborators all over both of those countries because they immigrated there. As Nazi Germany was rolled back, back in the 40s, you need a basis for that, and that is the only basis for that in Ukraine. And you have to remember, of course, that West Ukraine wasn't even part of Ukraine up until the years just prior to World War II. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth for centuries before that. So they were rabidly anti-Russian. They were anti-leftist, anti-communist. They were anti-Russian. And they still to this day are quite proud of the fact that they killed other Ukrainians, Russians and other Ukrainians, you know, Soviets.
Jews, too.
Yes, Jews, right, Poles, right, whoever, you know, to form an independent Ukraine. Right, that was their goal, an independent fascist Ukraine, to be sure.
Yes.
Because the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, Stepan Bandera, they were fascists. I mean, they were ideological fascists in lockstep with Hitler.
So
did they want their own fascist state independent of Germany? Sure. Was that on the cards for them? No.
He was crazier than Hitler. Hitler threw him in jail because he was too crazy.
Well,
for a
Hitler
while.
Threw him in jail because he was getting a little too big for his britches.
That's what I'm saying.
And Hitler wanted Ukraine as, you know, a part of you know, of territory to be colonized.
It's a
for
vast
the Reich,
state, yes.
Right? But while Bandera was in, quote, prison, unquote, he was still cooperating, holding regular meetings with the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists and the Nazis, encouraging them to work with the Nazis.
Yeah.
And when he was let out of prison near the end of the war, he put back on his Nazi uniform and fought in Germany, in Berlin, up until the end.
Yeah.
And was only later assassinated by Soviet agents after the war. So, yeah, I mean – That is the logic there. And to this day, I mean, the new Ukrainian regime since 2014 has proclaimed that these people, these perpetrators of the Holocaust, massacre of Poles, and killing of many East Ukrainians and Russians are national heroes and the founding fathers of the country. And if you deny that, then you are, you know, that is actually illegal. Historians have taken note of that, even in the pages of Foreign Policy magazine in
That's
the U.S.
Right. Yep.
And yeah. You know, that is not to say that Zelensky, you know, the comedian turned president who is now the head of the Maidan regime in Ukraine, right. But he's very well aware that the Ukraine that he has inherited and the only, you know, hopes to split Ukraine off of Russia is to keep these people online because they helped fight in the streets to overthrow the government. They helped fight in the early days to try to subjugate all of East Ukraine to the new regime when the military was paralyzed because they're like, we're not following this. And tens of thousands of Ukrainian military, police, and security services either just left their jobs or the majority of them actually defected to Crimea and thus Russia or to the Donbass. And you don't have to trust my word on this because the U.S.'s own state media, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, in a rare look at this, said that 75% of the Ukrainian Navy defected to Russia. But, you know, the only one who opposes what happened in Ukraine is Russia, right? No Ukrainians oppose. That is the narrative that has to be spun around all of this. Well, anyway, the U.S.'s maxim now, it must be clear that the U.S. has tried to push to bring Ukraine into and Georgia into NATO, no matter, you know, what the consequences of that would be. But if France and Germany and Hungary and a few other countries in Europe have been the have said no, that's not happening, not now anyway, because we don't want a war with Russia, and you know the U.S. is screaming that Ukraine is a sovereign country and must have the freedom to choose its own alliances. Well, really, I mean, is that the way that international relations politics works in the world today? Do you think that, say, Syria or Venezuela is free to choose Iran as an ally?
At least
not without U.S. punishment.
Right, punishment. I mean, well, they're sort of preemptively punished already.
Yeah, I mean,
the main commonality that you have both Venezuela and Iran are the, you know, subjects or objects of major U.S. sanctions, like surrounding their economies with a stone wall. And they're both oil producers who have had, you know, their oil wealth both messed with in the marketplace in unconscionable ways and stolen, just outright stolen in various Western banks and American banks.
The U.S. continues to occupy East Syria, where the oil and the wheat is, and demand that Iran must leave Syria, which, you know, Iranian forces there are there as an ally of the government.
At the invitation of the government and the people.
Yes, but the U.S. says they're not allowed to be there because Syria does not have the right to choose its own allies. Neither does Venezuela. All the U.S. screaming about them with Cuba, with Iran, with Russia. They're regularly attempting to overthrow Venezuela every year or two for how many years? You know, back into the past. This is going so far as to declare their own president for Venezuela, John Guaido, and so on. And let's take a look at Ukraine itself. Does the U.S. believe that Ukraine had sovereignty when they were sending their politicians in, their officials, their intelligence operatives to support, openly support, and help orchestrate the overthrow of the democratically elected Ukrainian government in 2014?
Well, to arrange on the telephone, on recorded line, arrange for the next leadership while there was an elected president.
They funded the creation of Euromaidan.
Right.
Euromaidan PR, that as well, but Hromadske, a media outlet that was started up just before the Maidan. And it was they were quite open about this fact on the U.S. embassy and the Dutch embassy's own websites. Those were the two that funded it. They funded it. They bought the equipment for it. They provided operating expenses for the beginning of it. And even the activists of the Maidan admit that this was the main organizing outlet of the Maidan protests against the government, and then, you know, the overthrow of that government. And the tagline on this U.S. and Dutch funded and set up media enterprise to create the Maidan was Revolutia. That was the tagline across the screen for 24 hours a day. Wow. Revolution. Right. But of course, the U.S. had nothing to do. This was the Ukrainian people. Never mind that polls at the time show that actually a majority, a slim majority, it must be said, but a majority of the Ukrainian people were opposed to the Maidan.
Right.
But we're supposed to, I mean, we're talking 51-45. I mean, this was polling agencies that are still used in Ukraine, well respected today. The articles about this were printed in the pro U.S. pro Maidan English language Kiev Post. You can find them to this day. Majority of Ukrainians opposed to Euromaidan, and this was in successive months. Right. But we're supposed to believe that the overthrow of the government there was some democratic thing. And we see that Ukraine is allowed to choose its own allies, according to the U.S., when there is a government, a regime put in place by the U.S. that makes the right decision on who to ally with. Because up until then, the administration had – the Yanukovych administration in Ukraine had balked at the altar – to the EU association agreement, and then started to pivot to Russia. That was not allowed. How dare he do that?
It was a shotgun wedding. That's why
he was targeted for regime change. That's so, right. I mean, the idea that countries are free to choose their own alliances. I mean, do you think Mexico or Canada is free to join a Chinese-led anti-U.S. military alliance? No, I mean, the tanks would be in Mexico City or Ottawa, before you could blink your eye if that was necessary.
Absolutely.
So we come to, you know, the current hysteria again. I think that there is more reason to be concerned this time. And this is because there have been a number of provocations by Kiev yet again. Whenever Russia has built up military forces across the border, it has always been to deter an impending attack by the Kiev regime to conquer East Ukraine, finally subjugate it to their seizure of power in 2014. You know, in violation of the Minsk Accords agreed to, you know, by Ukraine, Russia, France, Germany, the Donbass republics, and solidified in a UN Security Council resolution.
Right.
Of course, the Minsk Accords have long been ignored. Leadership, you know, political, military, the politicians in Kiev have long said we have no intention of ever fulfilling this. We agreed to it at one point when we were weak, but we feel stronger now, although that's questionable, and right. We're not going to fulfill this. And France and Germany, you know, recently said to Russia, hey, let's have another meeting of the Normandy 4 format, meaning France, Germany, the Kiev regime, and Russia. And Russia said, why? We haven't there has been no implementation of the things done for the last few Normandy summits. They said, okay, we'll do it. But how about you agree to actually pressure your client state in Kiev to begin implementing the Minsk Accords after 6 years by actually sitting down across the table with the political leadership in the Donbass and beginning the act of political settlement? Minsk Accords, step one.
Right.
And France and Germany said no. Right. Now, yep. The official, what was put out by the French and German governments originally was Russia refuses Normandy format meeting. And Russia said, no. That's not what happened. And they put out the actual diplomatic transcripts of the meeting, to which France and Germany were extremely upset exposed to that. And said, you refuse this. You refuse to implement the things that you are supposedly a guarantee for, telling Ukraine that they, Kiev regime in Ukraine, that they should do this. This is the end of the line. Kiev has once again massed forces in East Ukraine over the last few months, shelling of the Donbass, civilian areas, lots of injuries, lots of destruction of infrastructure, all of that, of course, war crimes, not that that's ever recognized.
Right, they are.
They have seized a settlement within the gray zone, the demilitarized area between the two, that is, supposedly overseen by the OSCE, without a word from the West that it even happened, much less condemning it. And Ukraine, the Kiev regime, has bought combat drones, Bayraktar TB2 combat drones for Turkey, which Turkey and Turkish allies used fairly effectively in Azerbaijan, Libya, Syria, and elsewhere, and launched an attack. Of course, any type of air attack against the Minsk Accords, much less new combat drones.
Right.
And at the same time, the U.S. ships 80 tons of ammunition to Ukraine. The Ukrainian military is now supposedly moved its U.S. supplied javelins, anti-tank missiles, to the front lines in Donbass. And the Biden administration is talking about sending them another tranche, because a few hundred million, 600 million this year is not enough. We got to send them more. We have to send them helicopters. We have to send them more javelins. We have to sell them mortars.
It's frightening what's going on. I know they're not allowed under the agreement. We have less than a minute left. I just want to say that, this is what's on the ground right now. And in the context of both the situation on the Polish border, where, by the way, Poland has troops dealing with the so-called migrant crisis, and a situation where it's shaping up over the oil and coal for the winter for Kiev. Even Timoshenko's talking about that. So we have to stop here because we are out of time. But Mark, thank you for setting this up for us, and we'll look at it further, hopefully talking about it prospectively still next week.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.